Oh, the oligarchy can't survive if the general public is united. So, this goes back hundreds of years, false flags and everything else. They must keep us divided. That is their primary goal, because as long as the public, and this is in the US and all over the world, as long as they're divided, they can't challenge them. All right, they're too busy fighting among themselves. So we're fighting among left versus right. That's the wrong fight.
Yeah,
The
agree
fight
more.
is
Agree more.
right. So it's a Hegelian dialect. It's engineered. That's why I say it's the curated lie. Everything people take to be true is a lie. There's no difference for the most part in our politicians in DC.
Carrie Lutz, Financial Survival Network. Good morning to you, my friend. How are you?
Hey, good morning, Andy. It's great to finally meet you and join you on your show. And I know you've done a lot of good work in your endeavors as a YouTuber podcaster, and I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, well, the pleasure is all mine. First of all, you're assistant sent me a copy of your book in a PDF, and I've been going through that, and that's really what I want to focus on. And to all my viewers and listeners, it's a fantastic read. And full disclosure, I have not, I need to go through it again just because there's so much great information in there. Where I really want to start with, how did this all start? If you would take me back to really, I would say the late 80s to the early 90s. That's not exactly where it started, but I think for the sake of this conversation, let's start there.
So I went to Pace University. I graduated in 1981, went to law school. But in my time at Pace, I saw a documentary miniseries on PBS of all places, with Milton Friedman and his wife Rose Friedman, called Free to Choose. And they made the argument that free markets work best in most situations. And this kind of led me down the path of Austrian economics. And like, I wanted to major in economics in college, but our economics department was mostly communist, and their main priority was unionizing the faculty of Pace University. Subsequently, they failed and they were fired, thank goodness. And as a result, I couldn't major in economics, so I wound up majoring in business. But I found all the Austrian economics books in the Pace University library, and I went to, I read every one of them, from Mises, Human Action, and there was a guy, Percy Greaves, and Murray Rothbard, all of those guys. And I kind of always believed free markets work best, but it appeared that our system was flourishing and working well until we hit the great financial crisis back in 07, 08. And I knew that crisis was coming. I just wasn't smart enough to play it like the guys in The Big Short did. But I absolutely knew that real estate was going to crash, because basically liar loans, no money down, interest-only mortgages, it was just rocket fuel for the eventual collapse that occurred.
Right. About that, I remember specifically, yes, everything that you just said, and you're actually quite the kindred spirit. Similar background, and I remember I actually had a hedge fund in 07. We were primarily natural resource stock based. When I say primarily, pretty much exclusively, and gold, if you would. And we got out of all of our positions, thank God, except for gold. And I remember when everything was crashing, and well, this is it. And I just remember I was sitting outside of a Barnes and Noble with my investor that seated us. We were just sipping coffee and just thinking about what does this look like now? So go ahead.
Yeah, so same situation. I was early to the belief that it was going to crash, but I used to park my car at a garage in New York, Deutsche Bank guys, all their Bentleys, their Rolls Royces, and they had this swagger to them. And then after the collapse, they were no longer swaggering. And, you know, it just, it really was an eye opener that they based their whole business model on leverage, basically taking these mortgages, slicing and dicing them, putting them into tranches, and then selling them off, making a fee, and rinse, repeat. And to me, it was like, I thought these guys actually knew what they were doing, but they had no concept of credit. Me as an attorney, having dealt in the consumer credit sector, recoveries, high value, even represented Donald Trump at one time, his casinos, I knew all about credit. And the shocking thing was these geniuses with all their computer, all that, were clueless as to incentives, as to the way the system was set up, and as to the inevitability of the collapse that they put into motion. They had no idea about this, and that's Wall Street. They don't care long-term. As long as they're making their money now and they can get their bonuses, they could care less what happens in the future. And to me, the crash really proved that. And it really made me disenchanted. You know, as being an Austrian economist, and I consider myself maybe not an economist by degree or by training, but certainly by experience, I always knew the system was fraudulent, fake money, all that. I'd been buying gold since 1999 and silver, and I knew it. But to see it actually collapse and then know that Mises was right, my mistake, probably similar to yours, was thinking that the Fed wouldn't actually reinflate and bail everybody out. But that's exactly what happened. And it's just set up the stage for the next major collapse that occurs, which no doubt is coming. 17-year cycle or so, 8.6-year cycles. Maybe it's here already.
Yeah. I remember going through that, and I was talking with my investor, and he was looking, I don't know why, but he was looking at, well, I do know why, because the conversation was seeing deep value. And I just said, his name was Joe. And I was like, Joe, how do you value a bank stock? Just tell me how, because I don't know how, because we have no idea. Nobody knows what they have on the books, what's going to default, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
You know, it's so funny that we're like totally on parallel tracks here, Andy, because I went to it might have been a American Association of Individual Investors talk conference. It wasn't a conference, but there was a guy there, Ralph Winter of the Winter Green Fund, which was a value fund. And somebody asked him a question, like, after Citibank had lost like 80% of its value, is Citibank a good buy? And he said, I know it looks like it's cheap, but you have no idea what's really on or off their balance sheet. And he said, there could be a footnote 87 that you don't know anything about, and you can't know anything about, even if you read it, that could cause the whole thing to blow up. And he was so right. Prescient in that diagnosis that I realized that I was pretty good, Andy, at reading financial statements, and I'm pretty decent at finding fraud, but the fraud could be so deeply embedded into a system that the whole thing becomes a fraud. And that's what happened to our financial system. And it really hasn't gotten any better. And you could argue, I'm sure you would, that going off the gold standard in 1970 was the beginning of it all, because they might have been able to fudge gold backing, but they couldn't totally eliminate it, or couldn't, you know, the discipline what it called for, they couldn't totally get rid of. And you could more or less trace everything that's going on now back to that fateful decision.
Yeah, you really can't. And it created a world with very high leverage and derivatives, which is what I want to get to. And not knowing if you would not have it an anchor in your whole economic system, if you would. And I think really that's where we're at. No, take me, if you would, take me through your book. You just came out with the book, The World According to Martin Armstrong. Let's start briefly.
Right here.
Available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, if I'm not mistaken. I'll link to everything in the show notes here.
Wherever fine books used to be sold.
Right? So take me through, I guess, really, after the financial crash of 2000, I'd say it was the top was 2007 going through 2009. According to Martin Armstrong, where exactly are we at? We had this re-inflation here with the Fed. And really, not only with the Fed, I think it was coordinated by the Fed, but really throughout the world with European central banks, with central banks of Asia. Where exactly, take me through that starting point. What happened?
Sure. So I basically, after the collapse, and I saw what happened, and I knew that the Austrians were right, I said, I can't keep doing what I'm doing here in the law. I really wasn't enjoying it. I just saw things, you know, that I didn't like. So I sold out my partnership and I kind of wandered around, and then I discovered the world of podcasting in around 2008 or nine, Gold Seek Radio. After listening to several hundred of them, I said, I could do this. And I took a course, Podcasting A to Z, with the podcast Answer Man. And I was a podcaster in 4 weeks, getting thousands of downloads. You know, this is back in 2010, 11. There weren't a lot of people doing it, and it just took off. And so I discovered Martin Armstrong through Jim Sinclair's writings. And I used to get Martin's newsletter when he was in jail, and it was typed out on a regular typewriter and hand-drawn charts and everything. And I really didn't understand it. And I realized there was a lot that I didn't know, that I didn't understand. This concept of the economic confidence model, the concept of flow of funds and exchange rates. And, you know, like I sent an email off to Marty, said, hey, I'd like to interview you for the show. And he said, fine. And that was 14 years ago, and I'm still interviewing him to this day. So I realized that nobody had ever like put together a compendium of all of his, predictions, his forecasts. You hear them individually, but you never saw them all together in one place. So I put together this book. I transcribed all of our interviews. I said, the world's got to know about this. And it's really been a major success. We've broken 2,000 copies as an independent publisher with no PR, no advertising budget. This thing just keeps selling, you know, 500 copies a month. And I went through and I picked out 13 or 14 calls that he made that I thought were good. And then I put it through AI and it came up with 18, some of which are mentioned in the book, some of which predated me, but like Dow 23,000 by 2018, predicted in 2011, it passed 23,000 in October of 2017. The Swiss franc peg break, which didn't get any air time in the United States. That was a huge, huge nail in the euro's coffin, and he nailed it. Trump winning in 16, gold rally starting in 15, civil unrest due to economic stress. He was calling that back in 2012. He was a little early there, but nonetheless. And then maybe his greatest call with us is Dow 40,000 by 2024 and over 44,000 by 2025. So, but 40,000, he nailed it. And he nailed that. I think he first said it in 17, But then he basically, in 2020, like after the market had collapsed, the Dow had gone from 28,000 to 21, and he was saying 40,000, somewhere between 22 and 24. Might have even been 45,000, but I can't find the exact quote. Call it 40,000. Nobody, Andy, you know him, nobody was making these calls. And then when you have an interview with him, you post it up there and you get hundreds of trolls from newly minted YouTube accounts, all saying disparaging things about him and never addressing his record of success here. He's not perfect. All right. I do believe there's a thing called divine providence that can change the outcome. But in the absence of divine providence, Martin Armstrong is the best thing we have.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I had him on earlier this year, and it was an honor, but it was also just astounding. What he's really taught me, and this is really what I want to ask you about, his theory, and it's just money flows, of where money is flowing, as well as central bank manipulation as far as interest rates and just flooding the system with money. And that money has to go somewhere. And I think that's really what, again, his thesis, which is playing out really, really well and has played out really, really well, that money has to go somewhere. It's a very highly, highly inflationary environment. So work that out with me, if you would, or talk to me about now, where we're at now, if you would, with okay. money flows, and what's your opinion on that?
Okay. So I should state first, I don't consider myself, I feel like, similar to you, a financial expert. Yes, I know a lot of stuff, but I'm not Martin Armstrong and I'm not Peter Schiff and these other guys, or Michael Pinto, another great guy.
Yeah.
I'm not them, but I'm 68 years old, lived through a lot of cycles, more than most of these kids who are on Wall Street now. And money printing is the ultimate perversion of the economic system, because it has unintended consequences. And Mises said, when you print money, it goes into the economy and has different effects. In the 70s, we had consumer price inflation, stagflation. In the early 2000s to now, we didn't have so much consumer price inflation, although we had that over the past few years. We had asset price inflation. And what the banks love about it is that they get the money freshly printed from the Fed before it's been devalued. And they get to invest it, loan it out. The problem is they get paid back in depreciating dollars, but with the leverage and all, they love inflation. Every asset-based entity loves inflation, because generally the way things are structured now, assets appreciate faster than prices of other items, if they can continue that. But we saw over the past couple of years, transitory inflation. You know, I don't know if you're buying the current inflation numbers or not, but I'm sure not.
Of that.
But going back to Martin Armstrong, the reason that we have the illusion of this economy that's doing so well compared to the rest of the world is because of the dollar flows into the U.S. And that's a result of two things. Result of loans being taken out in dollars, the ultimate short. That is the biggest short. And you've got the confidence model, where you see that, you know, I always say the U.S. economy is the best looking house in Baltimore. You know, it's like it looks good compared to everything else, because it's a dollar based system. And we get to keep printing and printing until the world doesn't want to take any more dollars. But at the same time that we're doing that, they're doing it as well. China, I mean, the U.S. is a piker in inflation compared to China. Their money supply is up 16-fold. Ours is only quadrupled since the beginning of, 2000s. And, that's what it distorts everything. How much longer this can go on, I have my own theory about it, but obviously it's kind of like my age. There's less days ahead of me than there are behind me. And that's the way it is for the dollar as well.
Yeah. So a lot of stuff going on there. And I have some theories here. I think I would agree with you on the dollar, but I think people that are negative the dollar, which I am, but I think that's the wrong question. I think it's the question of relativity, meaning relative to what? So, like, for example, if you're talking pure currencies, if you, compare it to the yuan or the, the euro, the yen, name your favorite currency, I see the dollar, and I'm not talking short term, I'm talking longer term because it is a dollar-based system. I don't see a dollar-based system necessarily going away. I do see it depreciating, and I want your thoughts on that relative to just about everything else that's a hard asset, especially specifically precious metals and gold. And that's what we've seen for the past, almost 25 years here. What are your thoughts on that relativity and just really the dollar's place in the system?
That really is the crux of the matter here. Because as long as the dollar system continues, then everything more or less goes on the way it's going on. I don't see necessarily a dollar collapse, but certainly depreciation. But the euro isn't being managed any better. And
worse, I would argue.
you wonder if this is just a circle jerk where they say, okay, now it's time for the dollar to be strong. Now it's time for the euro. Now it's time for the yuan. And we kind of go around in circles.
Right.
And nothing real is happening there. It's all what I call our way. Our society is the curated lie. Okay. Everything is a lie. Now, I don't know if you remember a group called Fire Sign Theater. They had they were a parody group, I think, out of San Francisco in the 70s and 80s. They were definitely an acquired taste. Like, it wasn't like George Carlin where everybody laughed, but they had a skit called Everything You Know Is Wrong. And, I thought that was entertaining when I heard it when I was like 16 or 17. Now that I'm 68, I realize that mostly everything I knew leading up to this point was wrong. And that's right. Because it's all a big lie. Everything's a lie, that the system is stable, that things are getting better, the economy's growing. Yes, we do have sectors that are, certainly tech, AI, all that is having a profound change. But look at our cities. Every major city in this country is in a prolonged state of collapse. Some more obvious than others. Baltimore is more obvious than maybe New York City but Chicago. And you go through these cities and you say like 45% of the world, of this country's population lives in these cities, and these cities are collapsing. How is the United States healthy? We can't seem to educate a kid. Comedian Jackie Mason used to say, when I went to school, they gave out homework. Nowadays, the kids get condoms,
Right.
So our educational system is shot. Now, for at least 45%, maybe probably 2/3, it's inferior in every way imaginable. And then you say like, but the news says everything's going good. The economy's growing. And yeah, the debt's growing. We've substituted debt for economic well-being. And, as individual investors, you and I, Andy, we can capitalize on that. Our timing might not be perfect, but Andy, I was buying silver at $8 an ounce after the collapse, $8 to $10. I bought as much as I could at the time. not that I could afford, but that I could store. And never store your metal in your home. That's a bad idea. That's one thing I tell everybody. You got to find some other alternative means of storage. I once wrote a report, use casino safe deposit boxes. They're free. You got access to them 24/7.
Great idea.
But you have to go there once a month. Now, like I go to the Hard Rock once a month to go see a concert or whatever, or to a couple other casinos in the area, no big deal. But that is a consideration and it's free. My point is at $8, I was never upside down on my silver. 100-ounce Engelhard bars for literally $995, I think I paid. So now silver is at 38.5. I think we are at the blowout point with silver. Just interviewed Rick Rule last week. He said the silver derivatives investors, he didn't say shorts, but derivative investors are going to get massacred. And because they manipulated it all these years, he said it's been short-term manipulation. But when does short-term manipulation become long-term manipulation? When it's consistent over a period of decades, right?
Right.
So silver, man, I just bought 90% quarters over the weekend for 3% under spot.
Yeah.
Under mil.
That's insane.
Like, that's a gift.
Yeah.
And yeah, like, and right now it turned into about 4% because silver is up today to 38.5. That $40 mark, Andy, is death for derivatives traders. And according to Marty, it's going to 50. And I believe it's going to triple digits myself, but I've felt like that a long time. I don't pretend to be Martin Armstrong. I can't come up with numbers like him, but I'm willing to listen to what he has to say and be influenced accordingly. Don't do everything they say because everybody can be wrong. Peter Lynch said that dumb money isn't dumb until it listens to the smart money.
Right. So let's work out really debt and your opinion on the debt and really, yeah, let's start with that. Let's go there.
All right.
I have this theory and it's this push and pull really with deflationists and inflationists. But I think what we're seeing is yes, the debt has to be, air quotes, repaid. Well, it has to be repaid, I think, if we are no longer in the dollar system, or elsewise, they'll just be inflated away. And that's what we're seeing. But when is that? I don't want to say a time point, but when is that? What's going to happen with that, the debt?
This is so great being on your show because it's like somebody who finally sees the world the way I do. More or less, you know, sure we have divergences. Here's what's going to happen. All right. I did this. I worked it through the AI, but I came up with the concept myself. Do you know who's contributing more than 50% of the Republicans' campaign contributions as we speak? What sector?
The
crypto.
What's
crypto.
Crypto.
Crypto. All right. Who is the first crypto bro president, the current occupant?
Trump.
Right. So let's just look at what crypto has done. If you invested 10 cents in 2010 and held it, your 10 cents would now be worth about 118,000 as we speak, give or take. To see crypto go to a million per coin, 10 million per coin, 50. It's not as big a stretch as going from 10 cents to 118,000 to see crypto go from 118,000 to 11 million, say, right? It's only a 100-fold increase. It's done a 1,000,000-fold increase here, Andy. Who is the largest crypto holder on the planet? Uncle Sam because of what he confiscated from Russ Ulbricht and Sam Bankman-Fried and a whole bunch of money launderers and drug dealers. Just 3-4 weeks ago, the AG, Pam Bondi, said we confiscated $225 million in crypto, which is probably now over $300 million in crypto. We have no idea what the government is really holding, if they've been acquiring over the past 5 years. Certainly somebody has. They're not making any more Bitcoin other than 450 coins a day, which gets halved again in another 4 years and another. It's only 7% of the actual Bitcoin out there trades. And yet we've got a derivative complex that kind of puts silver to shame. Open interest keeps going up. We are going to have the mother of all short squeezes. What's the government going to do? It gets to 10 million, 30 million a coin. Then they issue a stable coin based on Bitcoin, on the strategic Bitcoin reserve, and they pay off all the debt and recapitalize Social Security. That's their game plan. Now, I don't know if they could do it with a stable coin or they got to use the Bitcoin itself to do it. This is their plan. It's the only way out to have an asset that was originally valued at nothing. Through your efforts, you make it, through the efforts out there, you make it worth infinitely valuable, and then you trade it to get rid of your debt. There's a certain brilliance to it. I think this Scott Bessent is the smartest Treasury Secretary we've ever had. He's made allusions to this. I think this is what they're going to do. There's no other way, because what do? You default, you inflate, which is a form of default. Jubilee, all debts are forgiven. The economy turns to vapor overnight. Or you come up with the ultimate valuable asset and you trade that asset for your debt and wipe out your debt. Which one works best?
I think the former, the later, if you would. I don't know if it works best, but it certainly seems like that's what's going to happen. About crypto, to be very candid, I have owned crypto in the past. I currently don't own any crypto, and maybe I should. I just own gold and silver, which have been doing fantastic. But yes, crypto as, and it might have your answer on what you just said, is that somewhat of a Trojan horse, if you would?
You know, Marty says that it was created by some alphabet agency, and that certainly is possible. We got that Satoshi wallet, got like 750,000 or I don't know. I've heard all sorts of different ones, 1.1 million. And maybe it is. I don't know. I know there's a white paper out of dubious authenticity about it. Whoever created it, why they created it, it's turned into something completely different. And I was dumb, man. I knew about this. Trace Mayer, one of the original Bitcoin whales, told me to buy it at $5. It had gone up to 10. I said, I'll wait till it goes down to 7. It never hit 7 again. And, you know, I'm not bemoaning the fact I own it now. It was a very minor part of my portfolio that's become more major recently because of its increase. And we haven't hit the parabolic move yet in this current upcycle. We haven't hit it. And now the institutional acceptance and the derivative complex, when the derivatives blow up, just like with silver, that thing is going to launch forward and these shorts are going to get killed. And Bitcoin is worse than silver. Silver has some underlying physical supply that they can manipulate and accumulate and sell into the market to manipulate, which is what they do all the time. But there is no underlying Bitcoin that they can sell into the market. It's strictly a synthetic market, Andy. And believe me, I'm not the expert in the mechanics of how markets work. I guarantee you, you know way more having run your own hedge fund than I understand. Like, I don't understand option premiums. I don't understand spreads. I mean, I get the basic concept, but I've not traded, so I don't really get it. till your
no,
money
I think your answer
dries.
was actually fantastic. I don't think the right question, though, is the why. I think now it's taken on a life of its own, if you would, and it's accepted. And again, you see, and you just made a comment of institutional acceptance. There again is money flow. So let's say, work that out. So let's say it is a Trojan horse. It's almost like, who cares?
It worked for Troy. It could work for you.
But also, I think the right or the proper question, I'm just thinking about this as I'm on this call with you. It's fiat versus government fiat versus something else. And it's, again, going to money flow and relativity.
Yeah. I agree with that in principle. But in a way, gold is fiat. It just has a longer track record.
Right. Yeah.
Seashells. Yes. Remember, there were those tribes that used seashells, rocks in the water, huge boulders. They became money. So money.
Cattle, right?
Bitcoin is not money. It's never going to be money directly. You will never go to Starbucks and pay for a latte, your $6, with a Bitcoin-linked credit card. You'll use your fiat, your official government-sponsored fiat, because aggression's law. Right? That the bad money pushes out good money. Bitcoin is the ultimate store of value. Now, Andy, I am so late to the game on this. I'm like 8 years late, 9 years late on it. But I've watched and my eyes don't deceive. All right. This thing took off more than I could have ever believed. And it's partly a flight from fiat.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm not the expert, though. I'm just an observer like you.
Yeah. No, I would absolutely agree with everything that you said. Going back, though, it's interesting, too, because gold has had just this incredible run. And when I say incredible, it's nothing relative to the price of Bitcoin, but it's had this great run over the last really 20 plus years. And what I think is happening is other central banks, specifically China, are really sniffed that out, where I believe Bitcoin's illegal to own. So it's like, fine, if we're not going to own Bitcoin, or people's not going to own Bitcoin, or even the central banks, we're going to own gold. And that's why you've seen this huge, this good, steady, but a good 20% clip, it seems like, over the past 25 years of gold. So,
I couldn't agree with you more. I believe in gold too. I was buying it in the crash at 700 an ounce and had to part with a little bit of it to pay taxes, divorces, weddings and such, but managed to keep some. But you know, for sure, it still is important to the financial system, and push comes to shove, you know, it could be vital in the next coming system. But I kind of think, you know, and I still wouldn't sell any of my gold or silver. I feel like these little bits of intangible code that nobody can understand except the rocket scientists out there have kind of supplanted it, not so much for mine and your generation, but for the Gen Zs, the millennials, and those ones just past the millennials. They're not really Gen Xers per se, but between the Gen X and the millennials, you know, you're 40 or under, you're going to be more predisposed to buy crypto than you are to buy precious metals, which I think is a little short-sighted. You should have both.
Yeah.
You know, to just say that, to adopt Warren Buffett's viewpoint that gold is a barbarous relic, or who was that? Maybe that was...
Yeah, it was Warren Buffett.
Yeah. And that we spend all this money to dig it out of the ground, then we spend all this money to bury it in the ground in a vault and then guard it. There's a reason for that. You know, that His whole thing is a syllogism, and it's just not true, because gold has value. And as long as humanity's around, the Egyptians, they were trading it, the Sumerians, every civilization going back that we can, as far as we can go back, was valued gold and silver. So I think the millennials, the younger people, will come around, but crypto in some ways will replace gold. Thing is this, the next most popular crypto after Bitcoin is Ethereum, and there's no cap to that. Supposedly there's inflation protection in it. I don't quite understand it. It is vital to the digital infrastructure that's happening, but Ethereum, you could just keep printing it. And unless there's a hard cap on the currency, and then for another digital currency to attain acceptance like Bitcoin, I don't see it, but maybe it'll be some obscure coin we don't know about. For now though, it's really, you stick to Ethereum is like the silver and Bitcoin is like the gold.
Got it. Let's go back to Martin Armstrong. And I believe he touched on this book. And again, I need to go through it again, but talk about, or what's your thoughts on like this world being run, if you would, the system being run on this oligarchy, and then, work that out for me. And where is that going, or where we're at with that?
Yeah, well, the oligarchy can't survive if the general public is united. So, you know, this goes back hundreds of years, false flags and everything else. They must keep us divided. That is their primary goal, because as long as the public, and this is in the US and all over the world, as long as they're divided, they can't challenge them. All right, they're too busy fighting among themselves. So we're fighting among left versus right. That's the wrong fight. Right? So it's a Hegelian dialect. It's engineered. That's why I say it's the curated lie. Everything people take to be true is a lie. There's no difference for the most part in our politicians in DC. You know, in a way, Trump is the Trojan horse, because he doesn't go by the rule book that's in place, that has been in place, arguably since at least World War II, maybe World War I, maybe the Civil War. I don't know. It's been a rule book that you don't go against power and you don't try to right the wrongs. You make the wrongs look like they're rights and the rights look like they're wrongs. It's a giant psyop here, Andy. Yeah. You're living in one massive psyop. You and me, we've managed to peek through a little bit where the veil has thinned out, where, you know, the best I could liken it to is up until the 60s, Catholics were supposed to eat fish every Friday. I don't know the whole reason. I'm not a religious expert, but it was considered maybe a minor sin to not eat fish on Fridays. And then one day the Pope said, no, you don't have to eat fish on Fridays. It's okay. Now, was the Pope right when he said that? Or was he right when the church said you're supposed to eat fish on Fridays? I'm just using this as cognitive dissonance. It had to have set in to a certain number of people, but there's a certain number of people that said the Pope's infallible, and he was right then and he's right now without any further thought. And that's what it's been like with our government. We really believe them. And, you know, we bought into the PSYOP, and, you know, it didn't start out as a PSYOP necessarily, but certainly from the founding of the Federal Reserve and the imposition of the income tax and World War I, every day becomes more a PSYOP. And look at mainstream media news. It's dying now because they've lost all credibility. Trump's greatest contribution, controversy aside, is he exposed the system is broken and doesn't work anymore. And, you know, his solutions may or may not be working. I don't personally think this system can be fixed. I think it needs to be replaced. But Andy, how can you have a modern world like we have here without currency units, functioning currency units? Can't be done. It will be an extinction level event. If the entire global financial system collapses at once, it isn't like, okay, now we're using gold. It's like, who's got the gold? Where is the gold? And what do we do next? So it's dangerous. Historically, they've resorted to war to prop up these systems. But now the cost of war is just getting prohibitive. And, you know, Martin's predicting World War III. I'd like to believe it's not going to happen. But I've also learned you bet against Martin's forecast at your peril.
Yeah. Let's, I think I would agree with you with, I think, pretty much what you just said. It's no longer a one party against the other, if you would. I think the veil has been lifted, even though slightly, where it's become, people are becoming aware both parties are pretty much the same. They all go to the same, they all came from the same schools. They go to the same country clubs. They pretty much, you know, vote on the same things, if you would, and that's really to enrich themselves. They're all supportive of war, if you would. But it's becoming more of, okay, the people, I think the people are rising up and becoming aware this is really against the establishment, the people versus the establishment, if you would.
Yeah, and that establishment is the curated lie. Now, look, it's all a lie. You can't deny that living standards are better than they've ever been, that technology has led to improvements in our lives that were could only be dreamed of, you know, that the royalty, we live better than the royalty did 100 years ago, let's face it. But at what price? And at what point does the system become parasitic and start feeding off of us? And that's where we're at now. This whole corrupt system is parasitic, and a lot of people fall off. And, you know, when you look at the poor people, it's, there really are an example of capital failure, because they never understood, they weren't taught, like you and I were, obviously, that the most valuable capital is human capital. Whether that'll be the case with AI or not, to some extent, it's always going to be the case. So they, whether it's through failing schools, bad family dynamics, they never invested the proper amount of time and energy into developing their human capital. And I'm not talking about the person, it's happened to me, you go broke, you make a bad investment, bad business, your business goes done. You know what? It's that you'll recover from, because you've been successful once, you can do it again, invest more in your human capital. Now, these people have been stolen from because they were never given the opportunity to develop their own personal human capital. And that is the tragedy of modern society. It's not just here, it's all over the world. And because the one thing I've learned, every time I've invested in myself, learning something, getting better at it, whether it was podcasting, doing YouTube, computers, I've been working computers since 1977. It's like more years than I really want to admit here, but almost 50 years. And I'm not a coder, but I created applications, learned the thing before anyone else. And every time, I'll liken it to every time I've upgraded my computer over that period of time, it's always more than paid back the investment. And because when I upgraded my computer, I was actually upgrading my human capital as well, making it more productive and building upon it. And, you know, Rick Rule said this, and, you know, he really got me thinking in the last interview of the most important thing to invest in is yourself. And no matter where you are in life, you can always build your human capital. And now with AI, man, you can learn languages, you can learn finance, you can learn so much more than you never had the ability to from arguably the greatest combination of minds that the world has ever known. And you just tell the thing, hey, pretend you're Aristotle, tell me what I need to learn from you. And it will give you a list of things to learn, languages, whatever it is. So maybe that's the saving grace of AI, that it will enable all of humanity to invest in its human capital. And, you know, we just got lazy here in the US and mistook physical capital for human capital. And the two are very different.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with you. The best investment you can make in it is yourself. And I actually am very pro technology and pro AI, if you would. I think it's freeing the individual. I read a book, this was 1996 or 97. It was called The Sovereign Individual by James Dale Davidson. I don't know if it's still in print, but he wrote that. And it was basically that about how the world looks forward going 20, 30, 50 years in the future. And it's really just how nation states, as we know them, are going to shrink.
Mm-hmm.
And small sovereign entities, whether it's an individual or just a small, much smaller state, are going to rise up. A big part of that is with the internet and technology. And that's really what we're seeing. So I think if you really lean into technology and AI and learn, invest in yourself, you can participate in that, if you would, that economy, if you would.
I'm buying the book immediately. I'm going to cheat though, and I'm going to get it on Audible. Because
it changed my life. That was, I really mean, that was probably 30 years ago. I met him at a conference in the early 90s, and he was a keynote speaker. And anyways, that book really changed my life.
That's what you and I have been doing here. Sovereign means that you see the situation as best as you can for what it is, and then you determine your actions. I'll tell you a little something about myself. All right. I look at laws and I say, A, is there a reason for that law to exist? And if there is, and I agree with it, I'll follow it. If there isn't, but the penalty for ignoring that law is so great, I'll follow it. But if I'm on the highway and some government bureaucrat, and I'm not talking about my local road, but I'm on the highway, it's 3 a.m. and there is not a car on the road, and some bureaucrat decided that I should be driving 65 miles an hour instead of 85, I'm ignoring it because the penalty is not so great. I can go to court. I can beat the ticket. And this is the analysis that a sovereign person does. Sometimes it's not worth the hassle to ignore the law. Other times, taxes, it's not worth going to jail to avoid the law. But for most laws, like jaywalking in New York City, all right, it's like nobody, technically it's against the law. Jaywalking in Denver, you know, they might be a little, but you know what? I'll jaywalk wherever I feel like it. I'm willing to assume the risk. And, you know, and the other thing is I'm not going to ignore a law, even if I could, that me ignoring it is going to potentially injure others, right? Yeah. Kind of Doug Casey's philosophy, you know, that basically the first thing is do no harm, the Hippocratic Oath. So I don't want to hurt anybody, But then if I got a bunch of garbage laws, and sometimes a garbage law could cost you your life, and then you have to fight it, or you're not sovereign. So sovereignty over yourself, I'm glad somebody wrote a book about it. Now I'm going to actually read it, listen to it, is the ultimate, Andy, for all of us. We all need to become sovereign, because once the individual's sovereign, there is no sovereignty above you.
Right. It reminds me too of like our health crisis, if you would. Like, for example, I'm pulling this out of the air. It's like stem cells or fighting different diseases. You can go to different parts in the world and get great results, but for whatever reason, and I know the reason, but for whatever reasons, you can't do that here in this country. Why not? Why can't you get stem cells? And that law is changing here in the U.S. Why do you have to go to Mexico or Costa Rica or Germany or whatever?
Dominican Republic.
Why do you have to go to try an alternative message? And it might be kooky. Who knows? But why can't a practitioner here do that? For example, my wife and I were just talking the other day. One of our best doctors, he's no longer in practice here. He sold his practice because he was very adamant and critical of the government during COVID. And they shut him down. He was like, don't get the shot. That's basically was his promise.
No jab for you.
Yeah. And again, it's this whole idea of why can't you have autonomy here? And I hope people are getting that. So
I couldn't agree with you more. You know, like that is a perfect example, because you know what would happen if they eliminated orthopedic surgeries in all but the most extreme cases? That's like tens of billions of dollars that no longer gets spent. You know, like I don't know that. I'm quite familiar with stem cells. I worked with a stem cell clinic setting up the podcast a number of years ago, and it holds great promise. And I talked to people who'd had the treatments, and 2/3 of them all swore up and down that this is the greatest thing ever. So, you know, but we have regulatory capture. We got the big pharma, and mm-hmm. they've demonstrated, you know, big pharma, it's like, dating apps. Like the dating apps don't really want you to find that perfect person, and subtly they sabotage you. Big pharma doesn't want to cure diseases. They want to treat diseases. So you become a lifelong customer. That's their business model.
Exactly.
So, and that's a curated lie. Oh no, yeah. Big pharma is there to help. Yeah, they're there to help you, to sustain you, to become a lifelong customer. You know, that little but is really their business model.
Yeah, on that, and it's interesting. I have a really good friend of mine that had, from a previous life, he had a lot of health issues. And one of the health issues was his heart. And he was basically dying. And I work with a stem cell company, and they treated him. It was a machine. They treated him. He went to his doctor at here in the South. Hey, can I do this? And he said, well, you have nothing to lose. Basically, you're going to die either way. He got treated, and he got remarkably better.
Really?
Yes. And it was, why can't the stem cell company, if you would, make a claim, or why can't they use him as a case of getting better? Or why isn't this offered in every single state here in the U.S.? Well, because it's going to cost him, and he's on Medicaid, it's going to cost him, I don't know, $200,000 to $300,000 to go to his doctor and get all of these drugs that might help him, but this is going to have these other effects, or he's going to need surgery, and that's going to cost another $250,000. And it's all billed to Medicaid. It's because it's money making system. The incentives are wrong, if you would, for actually getting help or getting healthy.
So true. I couldn't agree with you more, man. It's like, we've been down this road before. We've seen it. We know what it's about. And, you know, this is what they do.
Yeah. Well, Terry, we'll end on that. If you could, if you could show your book again.
Sure. Sure thing. Right there.
World According to Martin Armstrong. You said you're selling, and I believe you. You got a ton of reviews on Amazon. It's in Barnes & Noble and Amazon. I want to thank you for your copy that your assistant sent to me. I have it in PDF.
I'll send you a hard copy.
I would love that. If you could sign it, that would be fantastic.
Yeah, we could do that. Absolutely. Yeah. In fact, I will send you this copy, the one that's right here on my desk, and just shoot me your physical address info, and it'll go out to you in the next day or so.
I really appreciate that, Carrie. I want to thank you so much for your time. I would love to have you on again and just talk, just spend some time with you and talk about this world we're living in, but also offer people some solutions about what we would do. And again, not saying what we're doing is right by any means, not advice, but just, but I think the best advice that we did, and also this advice, invest in yourselves. People need to recapture their own sovereignty.
And buy some silver if you got some extra money. Take those asymmetric bets, because if Armstrong's right, and we know what happens when you bet against him, $50 silver is right around the corner that will bust the shorts, or at the very least, they'll have to go long. I mean, I don't see any way the shorts can keep up the game once silver hits 40, 50 and goes higher.
Yeah, I would agree with you. Carrie, people want to, know more about your work. How do they find you online? What's your show and all that?
Podcast, Financial Survival Network. You can just go to the site, financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Everything I've ever done, going back at least 10, 12 years is there. Now I'm writing a lot of articles and books, and stay tuned.
Terry Lutz, I want to thank you so much for all you do for us. And thank you so much for your time.
Likewise.